Today, we are talking Knock.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Talkin' Knock. I am your host, Tristan, joined by the King of Corn himself, Peyton. How are you doing today, Peyton?
Why am I all of a sudden the King of Corn to you?
Because you're from Nebraska, and it's the only defining feature about that state.
Sadly, you're not wrong.
So today, we actually really don't have any housekeeping stuff, just to let everybody know that, hey, we have social media. It's linked in the description of this podcast. So like always, give it a click and go ahead and look at what we've got. If you're interested, we put all of our art up from these episodes. So anything that we mention here that we talk about on the show is going to be up on that social media. We have Twitter and Instagram and all that jazz. But what have you been doing in RPG since last time we talked?
Well, funny you say that, because I had a nice grand old session that ended with the Paladin saying that she couldn't handle how Mimi, the RP rogue, was being and straight up left.
Oh no, that doesn't sound good.
So yeah, we're searching for another fourth right now, but other than that, it's going along fine.
Oh my gosh, yeah, we obviously we didn't have DCC this week. Just every single person except the two of us had something come up right before the session started in terms of being late. And after about a half hour, we're like, yeah, you know what, we're just going to call it for the night and reschedule for next week, but I'm sure that everybody listening has dealt with that at least once. But I did play Red Markets. I'm still in that, like, we're doing like a four session shot instead of a one shot. And it has been very fun. I'm playing Terry Crews, but it's spelled like Ted Cruz because we're in Texas. And it's like a zombie apocalypse game. And yeah, I'm playing Terry Crews, who rides a bike and uses a silenced crossbow. So it's a good time. This week, we're still on Knock 1 by Olivier Revenue and Eric Nyden, obviously. And speaking of Olivier, we are actually starting out with one of his articles is a strong word. It's another one of these like reference tables that you can use at the beginning of your game. It's called Get Your Gear, and it's a D66 to kind of get your starting gear for the game. The art is by Matthew Houston, who we have actually seen before. He did the really cool art for a comparison of old and new D&D. And this art is very different from his other one, which I can't really decide how I feel about it, but I think it's certainly better than anything I could do.
To me, it looks like something that you'd see more in like a lighthearted kind of Tony magazine, you know? Like, it's not bad. It's just, it kind of looks like it would fit a more comedic setting than the weird esoteric stuff that Knock has been going for.
Yeah, it's just a little bit of a different vibe, which I think I'm fine with. And I think that for this, it's especially for some of the goofy results that you can get on this table, that I feel like it fits fairly well. Like I said, this one's kind of just a D66 to get your starting gear. It's got little kits for you to go through. What were your favorites from the list?
Well, one of my first favorites was on the front page, number 13. Shabby leather armor, bow and 20 arrows, two short swords, shoe polish kit, a bottle of milk, and three kittens in a basket.
Yeah, I feel like that's a fun one.
Yeah, I just like it because kittens in a basket, what can I say? They're cute.
Yeah, I agree. I think the first one that I liked was number 24, which was chainmail, a glaive, a heavy crossbow, like normal stuff. Then feathered hat, and this did get a chuckle out of me once I realized what it was, but it's a walkie-talkie, and it's a box said to communicate up to a distance of 1 mile with a person owning another walkie-talkie. So I thought that just was like a nice little thing that once I realized what it was, I was like, all right, that's good.
Well, the other two I like are kind of related in a way. The first one is number 22, which is studded leather armor, helmet with a black feather, saber, short bow and 27 arrows, flask of flammable oil, small bronze bell, and 27 gold teeth in a purse. And the other one was number 65, which is brigantine, long cutlass, hatchet, slingshot and 20 stones, pointy wizard hat, red baggy trousers, and finally, smiling two-headed homunculus in a glass jar.
Yeah, those are good ones.
The reason I like two of those is because the character Kimbra in our current DCC game, he just seems like the physical embodiment of someone who would carry those two kind of inventories.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point. I just had to rewrite his character sheet into Fantasy Grounds, and good God, him and your character, the Archivist, had so many items. I just was like, Oh my god, this isn't over yet?
I just had the items because, you know, wizard and scrolls and spells and stuff. Meanwhile, Kimber over here, you know, he's had a vial of gonorrhea at one point.
Yeah, that was definitely not a PG-13 session. Anyway, yeah, my last one that I liked. I just liked, it says there's one of them that starts with a brigandine with the Sons of Xenopus gang emblem. And I just thought that was like a nice touch because I feel like it adds anything that just has like a small non-committal name or area on it like that really just adds something to your game, because then your character can come up with what that is, you can come up with that what that is, and it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, I kind of like how that, and honestly a lot of these are kind of worded in a way in that it's not like it gives you a bunch of baggage to your character, but yet it's also, the results are varied enough that you could probably come up with a 30-second backstory to any one of these.
Yeah, and that's exactly like Mothership, which we are actually, I'm showing you on Halloween. That's our Halloween game that we're doing this year, but I've played it a few times, and it has this whole system where you get like a badge and some type of trinket. And those two things together really can just add a lot to your character. And I'll put a link for Mothership. They're actually about to do a big Kickstarter for their box set. So I'll put that in a link in the description of this podcast episode. But our second article is The Village's Local Retired Adventurer. This is the same guy, Daniel Sell, who did Wizard Weaknesses, which is that fun one that we did last week that you really liked. And the art is by Luka Rajek, who is a enormous RPG developer. He did Ultraviolet Grasslands, Witchburner. He's done some OSE adventures, and I'll put a link to DriveThru in his website. But he did the art, which is like this really interesting looking knight kind of looking sideways off in the distance. And he always does these really poppy pastels and like neon colors, like psychedelic stuff. But I really like it normally.
I like it because when I first looked at it, it gave off really big Gorillaz vibes.
It does definitely give Gorillaz vibes, I agree.
So yeah, I mean, it just, I love it. Looks amazing.
It's basically, this table is just some dice that you can roll to get a really quick backstory of a village's local retired adventurer. So it's got how old they are, what they have a reputation for, what their past is like, how you can get their services, and some kind of character flaw that they have when they go on an adventure with you, which I thought was a nice touch. I think the last two tables really spiced up the whole article.
Yeah, I feel like you said, the first three tables are all right. They just kind of lay out a basic explanation, you know, who they are, how old they are, what's their reputation, that kind of stuff. But the last two tables that explain how you can actually gain their services, and if they're taken on, how they'll act, it really gives this feeling of, you know, the NPCs are in a living, breathing world.
And I think that it's also basically 90% of a hireling table too. So I'm definitely going to pull from this, because you guys are finally getting at the point in our campaign where you're having more money, you can hire retainers and people who can be there for you. And I feel like this is a good table to give just a quick backstory to, hey, guy who's holding my armor who comes with us, or guy who's the torch holder or whatever. And that way they feel a little bit more alive rather than just like NPCs in Skyrim who have the same four lines all the time.
And as an added bonus, if they feel alive, that means that your players are going to get attached to them and will be less likely to be murder hoboing with them.
It's always going to be fun if, for instance, your guy who is cooking for you just is unable to be in the presence of cooking meat.
Yeah, there's certain quirks like that. When they're given to you in a way that you have to roll with the punches, it makes stuff so much better.
So our last article is really where the meat of this episode is going to be, because it's the largest one by far, and it's actually an article rather than just kind of tables that we're looking at. But this is Dungeon Checklist by Arnold Kemp. He has both a Patreon and a blog spot, both of which where he's known as Goblin Punch, so I'll link that. And it's, again, we've got art by Michael Shepard, and he does this really cool mirror with a implied face of a demon inside of it, and I actually really, really like this one.
I like it too, but then again, I'm kind of biased towards magic mirrors and dungeons.
Yeah, magic mirrors and hard black and white lines are my fetish.
Yeah, and the fact that this mirror here looks very grim dark, it really adds on to the atmosphere.
Arnold, if I may call you that, Arnold, divides this article into 7 points of what he thinks needs to be in every dungeon that is being designed. So the first of which is something to steal, which I mean, yeah, it's pretty self-explanatory. He really doesn't go into depth on what that means because you need a reason to go in there. But I think where this article shines is a lot of his examples that he gives. So I'll let you give your opinion on this first something to steal area.
So I agree with pretty much everything in here. I really love his point that, you know, don't be conventional with what they have to steal. You know, spice it up. And sometimes it's not just gold coins. You know, you might find something that you have to convert 3 or 4 steps through a quest or something to actually get money out of it.
Like the point where he talks about giving your characters trade goods. I loved that. I thought that was great. And making it be something that's worth a lot of money, but then they have to deal with the selling off of. In his example, it's a wagon full of tea. Of course, you're not just going to be able to roll up to the town and be like, hey, I got 10K worth of tea here. There you go. Like, you've got to peddle it. You've got to go to different areas to not flood the tea market. And I really, really liked that idea as a reward.
Yeah, one reward that I'm using in my, I guess, now halted game. I actually picked this up off of a mechanic that I saw in some other OSR game. But I basically give them these kind of coins that are only valuable in a certain area where they can be traded in like a 1-to-1 normal gold ratio, right? However, they can also take it to a local blacksmith who will melt the ancient coins down into gold bars for legal tender elsewhere. However, because he's the only blacksmith in the area and he knows it, he takes 50% cut.
Oh, I like that. That's fun. The second point that he goes into is something that needs to be killed. Again, pretty obvious, and he even says that's the first line. The part that I liked was he's talking about making sure that your dungeons are telling a story through the monster. So instead of just having orcs or goblins or zombies or something that really has kind of lost any sense of fear, he kind of just talks about reskinning it a little bit. Have the goblins, you know, take dwarven armor. Have the zombies be cannibalistic dwarves who like lived in this cavern and now have reverted to like these cannibalistic ways because of some cataclysm. And you don't even need to change the stats. Like, you can still make it a zombie, just change it into being something weirder.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that this would be the perfect time if you were making a dungeon to go reference the previous Cocktail Codex article about the Lich.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. That would be a great place to bring it in. And something that I want to add too is a little touch that I do when I'm describing creatures, and you can attest to this, but I don't name anything that you guys are fighting. It could be a goblin. I am never going to call it a goblin to you. I'm going to say these green-skinned, beady-eyed creatures, because it's having a description versus having the pop culture in your head, I feel is kind of a disservice. I feel like it's better if I can get you to see something rather than to just think about when you saw it on TV.
Yeah, I think it's fine to kind of use these overarching terms for creatures if you're in a medium where you can also display it visually. If you're in something like a tabletop game, it's a lot better to leave stuff up to the imagination just by, like you said, using descriptors instead of a word that already has connotation behind it.
Taking more time to describe things and creatures that I'm dealing with has made me a better runner of games because I'm trying my best to make you visualize everything that you're seeing. And I'm not going to go down the theater of the mind rabbit hole that we go down all the time, but that's where I stand on that.
Yeah, I'm not going to go down the theater of the mind rabbit hole too. However, I will say that even if you aren't using Theater of the Mind in games like DCC, where you have the Mighty Deed system, having a creature really well described to you makes it a lot easier on the player to come up with a Mighty Deed.
Yeah, exactly. The mechanical portion meeting the description portion.
Exactly.
His third point is something to kill you, which I feel like kind of 2 and 3 could probably be mixed together. But I kind of get his point with something to kill you because it's much more based on projecting that something is dangerous for your players so that then they can make the choice to run if they want to, which, like, he says that he thinks it's a big part of OSR, which I agree with, and sometimes it takes a bit for my players to realize, oh, wait, we can just run away instead of just smashing into this thing over and over again.
So here's where I kind of started having some disagreements with the article. I agree with the majority of what he's trying to say. However, in his second paragraph, he says that dungeons need to feel like they were designed to be unbeatable. I think that, like, yes, that can work. However, always having these kind of like fortress style dungeons kind of leads to a homogenization of what you would expect out of a dungeon and kind of takes, I don't know, like the exploration joy out of it.
That's a fair point, because sometimes I think that what he is talking about is specifically the cut and dry OSR meaning of the word, where you are going and exploring dungeons as adventurers. You don't necessarily do some of the character design portions that we tend to do in our games, where you bring in storylines and you're going from place to place and dealing with stuff that actually all relates. And I think he's focused more on, like, if you were exploring a dungeon, it needs to feel dangerous, which I agree, but there also can be these like fun side areas that aren't necessarily always super deadly and always geared specifically against the players.
I guess I'm just going to let you move on to 4 now, if that's okay, because my opinions on what you just said also kind of tie into 4.
Yeah, works for me. So number 4 is different paths, which basically talks about don't make your dungeon a point A to point B adventure. Have cuts off, have it loop around, have it come back on in itself. And his reasoning for this is that it allows your players to circumvent problems and also use the dungeon to their own ends once they reach a point of dungeon mastery, which is actually something that we recently saw in our games, where the players were fighting these cats that had like these flaming crystals in their head and they were chasing them, and so they dropped a portcullis to keep the cats on the other side of them and kind of keep themselves safe, and they were able to kill that thing using the dungeon's traps, which they'd fallen for earlier.
Yeah, and in those kind of use cases, I agree. However, I feel like he has a very big emphasis here on simply using different paths as a way of avoidance, when I feel like that kind of goes to the antithesis of how most players would play, not necessarily OSR games, but just like board games or other kind of games in general, where they're kind of led on to assume that a hidden path would either lead to more treasure or a way to stealthily kill these people and other stuff like that. And when you find a hidden path and it only goes somewhere else and it doesn't even offer you a way to help beat the encounter that you know is up, and it's kind of like the gate check to you, the burden of playing wrong feels like it's being put on the player, because having been in that position before, it just feels like we're doing something wrong and not, oh, we can go do this instead.
I can understand that. Yeah, I think more what it is there's no right way to clear a dungeon. Like, yes, you have your task that you're going to do, and that's fine, but you don't have to clear every room to complete that task. Like, and I think that's more kind of what he's going for. Like he says, it allows parties to walk away from rooms they don't like. If they know that this is a large complex and there's more to explore and more to go, it kind of helps get rid of that whole like World of Warcraft aspect where, yes, you can go down another path, but really it just is getting you some other leg up later on. Like when you fight like a mini boss somewhere else, that gives you something that then you can fight the main boss again. And I think it's kind of trying to train that out and kind of get you more to a, hey, this dungeon was here whether or not you are trying to get to your specific end, and it could be completely different once you clear it out and then you leave and come back and it's something completely different in here. And I think that's kind of what he's going to go for.
Yeah, and again, like, I like the original premise, I agree with it to a point. I feel like this mentality of having something that is so lived in that it doesn't even take account for what the players are doing is fine. It's just when stuff like that is happening, generally it isn't telegraphed very well, and the players are usually supposed to just go and bash their head against something. I mean, you know, not the same way, but continuously figure out something different until they decide they can't do it and leave, which, it, like I said before, it just feels like the player's doing something wrong in that situation.
If you're doing all of these together, hopefully that shouldn't happen, because number 5 is having someone to talk to in the dungeon in some way. And this is one that I feel not strongly about, but this is something that I really agree with, because I think that having every single thing that you're interacting with be hostile leads you to not even want to hear out anything else that's going on. You're like, all right, well, when is the twist when this thing's going to try and kill me? And I think that having someone to talk to in the dungeon, whatever that may be, really makes the players kind of take a step back and be like, okay, how do we want to interact with this thing before we just go gung-ho in and try and kill it?
Yeah, I when I was reading this article, I thought to myself, yeah, I agree that every dungeon needs someone to talk to, but like, there's no way that you can actually come up with an NPC to talk to for every dungeon, right? And then I went on to read some examples, and it's like, damn, this guy actually basically listed an example for every kind of dungeon you need.
Yeah, and every single one that I've run for you has had someone to talk to in it. And you just, because some of them are just so, like, small and they fit in so well, they don't really stand out as, oh, this is the thing that I'm supposed to talk to this time, you know what I mean?
Are you telling me that not every creature needs to be some higher dimensional being chained with pentagrams?
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that happened in our last game where you ran into one of them. You were all ready to fight this thing that you ran into. So you freed it and you were like gearing yourself for a big fight. And then it was like, all right, thanks, peace. And just like disappeared. And so then when the next one came up, you guys were a little bit more like, okay, let's hear this thing out. And I didn't want like, yes, I could have been like, ha, trap. But then you're never going to have that experience again. So I feel like it pays off to kind of have some things that will help you and some things that are just there to talk to, some things that'll help you in a campaign, and some things that are then going to backstab you. And I think having a good mix of all of those is perfect.
Yeah, and I do kind of want to point out how you said that, you know, how we approached the second NPC different because of our experiences from the first, right? I like that you pointed that out because it kind of plays into my earlier point of telegraphing things that will happen that are out of the norm.
Yeah, that makes sense. I get what you're saying, for sure. In terms of things to kind of deal with in your dungeons, number 6 is something to experiment with, which is basically talking about, be they traps or puzzles or just something to get your character's mind going so that it's not just, okay, when's the next thing we kill? When's the next thing we deal with? And it's just kind of like a pause where it's like, oh, let me think this through critically instead of just trying to bash my head against it and knocking down everything like a bowling pin.
Yeah, and just the wacky, over-the-top kind of examples he gives, you know, also paired with the examples that, you know, you've ran for us in our campaigns. I love how it kind of encourages this organic, like, everyone is on an equal playing field, how do we do this? Rather than the precedent that's usually set of the most powerful character looking in their tool belt to see how they can fix it.
And it really kind of gets rid of the roles for a little bit, which is something I am a big fan of. Less classes are better because I think it's better if there's less archetypes for your characters, because then it means that everyone's kind of getting able to do something and it's not just, okay, let this guy break down this door, let this guy try this, let this guy try that. It's like, okay, I'm gonna try that kind of thing. And I think that these experimental areas are perfect for that, because using an example from our last one, there were these pedestals that had an item that the characters wanted on top of them that whenever they got close, it like teleported away, and they spent like probably a good 15 minutes of real lifetime trying to figure this thing out before Steve was like, well, can I push it over? And I was like, yeah, go for it. And he pushed it over and it completely canceled the magic. And he was like, oh my God, we just spent like 15 minutes dealing with this when this is all we had to do. And I was like, yeah, just think about it.
Like I said earlier, just the whole thinking about it, everyone is outside of their class mindset. Everyone is outside of like, this is what my character normally does because of the meta. It makes the party actually feel like a band of merry adventures than just a bunch of cookie cutter things going through a game.
Exactly. It's less just, okay, here's another band of murder hobos, and more, oh, hey, these people are actually people and they're, you know, dealing with problems that they're running into while doing what they've chosen to be their job, which I think is cool.
While also still being murder hobos,
exactly. So this last one, I think we might have different opinions on. This is something the players probably won't find. What did you think about this one before I get into it? It's obviously, the title kind of explains what it is. It's an item somewhere in your dungeon. Item, runes, lore, whatever you want it to be. But just something the players won't necessarily find.
This article really just goes into depth about a bunch of different ways to add a bunch of different, you know, types of loot to your dungeon in a way that not every player is going to find, just to really reward the adventurous. And I have to say that if if this were a contained, one-off, sandbox, whatever, dungeon, I completely agree. However, I think that sometimes there just needs to be dungeons where you will go 4 or 5 rooms without finding anything now, no matter how hard you search. Because it, like, if every dungeon is described in the way that he wants loot to be laid out in a dungeon, then all of a sudden, you know, loot becomes expected and the norm, and it devalues the joy of exploration, which is the feeling that he wants to bring back using these methods.
I, you know, after you saying that, I think that I agree a lot more with that sentiment than I thought I was going to. And I think you're right, and I think it's good to have empty rooms every once in a while. Maybe not empty, have something like related to telling you the story of what's going on with the dungeon, but not necessarily something that is, oh, I'm going to find loot in here. Oh, I'm going to find something else if I just keep searching everything.
Yeah, and he kind of curtails this a little bit with the examples of loot he gives. However, he still kind of implies that even though you don't have to give them like permanent player power through gear or knowledge or something like that, you can still reward them with temporary power, like, you know, torches and stuff, which I agree is okay. However, I don't think that should be the bottom line. And like you said, you know, a lot of people who explore are doing it for the sake of exploration. You know, like, loot is there, yes, but sometimes they just want to learn about the world. So maybe they find a journal in a bedroom that just kind of explains, like, maybe this is what a commoner's life is like in this world.
Yeah, or like, for instance, in our game, paintings that kind of outline, oh, this is going to be our big bad. We just don't really know that at this moment yet.
Yeah, like you said, that room, it was just a room, didn't really have anything super important in it, but it kind of set the scale of, like, you know, this is like a dingy-ass dungeon, but the people on top, like, they're this royal court, living this bougie life, and I thought that despite that room being rather mundane, it added a lot to the background of the dungeon.
And something that is my own personal opinion and something that I do is, if you guys are really thinking critically in a room where I didn't necessarily have something that I was going to give you in there, and obviously I still leave rooms that have nothing in it, as evidenced by our friend Steve searching this bedroom for what had to be like 10 minutes of real life time, and I was like, there's nothing in there, you're good, like, you found everything, it was just some coins in the bed. But I will move stuff around if the whole party seems engaged with the room and they think that something's weird about it. Yeah, I'll let something be weird about it in the end. Like, for instance, those paintings that I just mentioned weren't going to be in that room. They weren't at all, but you guys were all, like, trying to think your way through what could possibly be in here, because it seemed like an important room because it had all this opulent stuff in it. So I was like, sure, yeah, there's something in here that you guys find that kind of gives you a telegraph about something later. It's not necessarily anything powerful, but it's knowledge.
Yeah, and also, on top of what you just said, I think a great idea in those kind of situations would just, you know, maybe when you look at the module or dungeon or, you know, wherever you get the setting that you're running, you can maybe like make a list of loot on a D50, D100, or just tiny mundane trinkets, that kind of stuff. And if a party is really hell-bent on searching, and despite, you know, you or the dungeon author trying to convey that, you know, maybe this is a sparser dungeon, you can just roll on the table and be like, oh, you got this trinket. There you go.
I have so many random tables around my office where I run games from, because they are invaluable. For any game that you're running, a random table is going to save your butt one time or another.
Not only is it going to save your butt, but it's also going to save you a lot of time in the prepping before the session.
And it'll save you time because inadvertently, those trinkets end up being something that the players are going to latch onto and be like, what is this weird thing? I want, like, the anti-gravity raisin from last session. Like, of course, someone's going to grab onto a floating raisin and want to figure out what the hell it is and what they can use it for.
Yeah, you know, on a more wholesome side, it kind of gives this natural kind of exploration. And maybe on the more selfish side, it means, oh, thank God, I'm able to stretch out this content so that, you know, I don't have to prep more next time.
Yes, and your players will probably just take it in their own way, and that's fine. Like, you're making stories together. But our last point tonight is we do our listener questions that we do every episode, and we've got one from actually another podcast called Tale of the Manticore. It's an OSR podcast where he's kind of doing like an audio drama using like some solo play. It's fantastic. Check him out on Spotify, and I'll link it in the description of this video. But he asked, for those of us who have heard of DCC but never played it, what are the key differences and similarities between it and OSC or other BX clones? And he followed that up and said, oh, actually, I just listened to your last episode. You talked about that a little bit. To be more specific, how do attacks work? How does the magic system work? What kind of stuff like that? Do you want to describe the attack system and I'll describe the magic system and some of the stuff like that?
I can. However, given how none of my characters use like shield bash or extra action die or mighty deeds, I want to maybe explain it the other way around.
Let's do that. Yeah, we'll flip it around. So the attack system in the game is pretty similar to everything else. Obviously, it's a D20 system, but the cool part is there's a dice chain. So you've got all of these DCC weird dice with air quotes around it that go from a D3 all the way up to a D30. And basically, they use this dice chain because statistically it gives more interesting results than just using advantage and disadvantage. So obviously, if you are doing something with what would be advantage in 5th edition, you do it with a dice step up. So you roll a d20 normally. With a dice step up, you're rolling a d24. If you are dealing with something bad, instead of a d20, you're using a d16. Just that's the general rule for a lot of the mechanics in it. Warriors have these cool things called Mighty Deeds. These Mighty Deeds are basically, in every other game, they're combat maneuvers, so like tripping your opponent, grappling, all of that stuff. It's really simple down into each warrior or dwarf has a deed dice. If they roll over a certain number, then that deed goes off, but they also have to hit the opponent. Otherwise, it doesn't go off. But it's just a variable attack modifier, so you can still get the damage off. So it's really fun and variable. I think my favorite part about DCC is how much is baked into the system just as it is. It just has a lot of character and a lot of storyline developing things that have happened solely because of the tables in the game. And I'll let you describe the magic system because you just recently had some catastrophic failures with the magic system.
Yeah, so the reason I like the magic system is because it seems like in every other setting I play, magic is a very static kind of thing, where in DCC, if you're familiar at all with the Warhammer 40k universe, the magic users are a lot more like psykers in that, you know, the higher you roll, the more powerful your magic becomes. Like, you know, rolling a D24 result is going to net you a lot more magic missiles, since, you know, that's the primo example everyone uses.
Yeah.
Then, you know, rolling a 12, which will just get you, you know, one that does one damage. But also, on the flip side, like psykers in 40k, if you roll a nat 1, all of the sudden there are tables upon tables of what you have to roll to just determine how badly you fucked up and just who is gonna die and all this cool stuff. It can go anywhere from your skin maybe changes a different color around your arms to all of the sudden your face is a snake to, oh, hey, you have a giant rock orbiting your head that is going fast enough that if anyone gets within 3 feet of you, they take 1 point of damage. Yeah, all of that is from rolling a one and misfiring. It just makes nat one so much more fun.
Yeah, and every spell has these tables, like Peyton just said, and the best comparison that I've seen is someone said when you shoot like a magic missile at your lowest ability that you can, it's like a normal magic missile from any other game, and then if you max roll magic missile, it's like using an ICBM to hit someone across the world from you with a bunch of magic missiles.
Yeah, I remember spell burning, and don't worry, I'll get into what spell burning is in a bit, but spell burning a bit to pump up the juice on my magic missile. And it did, like, what? Like, I had to roll, like, a D8 to determine how many missiles I had, and each one did, like, D6 plus caster level damage. All of that is so much better than, you know, rolling a 12, and it's like, oh, you tickle them.
The thing that I like the most about the system, I think, is how fluid the characters are. You are obviously your own character and everything like that, but your stats, your movement, how you take damage, all of that is so fluid that it feels like you actually are getting your like a toll taken from you by venturing. And it makes a lot more sense why, hey, not everybody is doing this. Yes, there's a lot of money in it, but you may not die, and that's fine, but you might be crippled for the rest of your life and have to retire solely because your character can just not go on anymore.
Yeah, going into the whole stats being malleable thing that you were talking about, for example, in magic, you can spell burn your physical attributes, and for each point you burn, you get a +1 to your roll on your next spell. And you get these back one a day after a full day of not spell burning. And so what this means is that magic users can kind of use their physical attributes as more of like a malleable mana battery than like actually just using their strength to hit something with a sword. For example, is when elves cast their patron bond spell to bond to a patron, the amount of buffs you get from that patron depends on your roll, because like I said earlier, each spell has tables depending on how high you roll. Well, I spell burned like almost all of my physical attributes, knowing that I'd probably have a decent rest after doing it. And that gave me like a +13 to my roll, and it allowed me to edge over just getting max roll with my patron. And that kind of like excitement and just great feeling is something I haven't gotten in any other game.
Yeah, and it worked out too, because you also instantly used all of the new toys you got to make yourself go into debt with your patron, and now he expects a bunch of stuff from you. So if you want to learn anything else about DCC, obviously we're not just a DCC podcast as much as we love it, but something that is a DCC podcast is Spellburn, which is a fantastic podcast run by some really great people. You should go check it out. They have like a whole section explaining each portion of the game in really, like, in a lot of detail. So you can just listen to that for like an afternoon and you can feel confident about running the game. And for me, I listened to that while reading the rule book, and then I went to a con and ran a bunch of games, and like I knew all of the rules going in, and it felt great.
Yeah, I kind of gotta agree with you there in that DCC for me, it seems very hard to get into, but the rules are actually pretty light. It's just, you just got to get used to using your imagination.
Yeah, don't get scared by the rule book. The rule book's enormous, but it's like 75% spells for clerics and wizards.
Yeah, because each spell has to have like 2 pages dedicated to all their misfire and corruption tables and all that stuff.
Yes, for sure. So that's about all I have today. The last thing I want to talk about before we sign off for the night is what we're talking about next week. Next week, we are doing the 2 articles, What Kids RPGs Are Missing by Ben Milton, as well as Wandering Monsters Should Have a Purpose in Wandering Around by Bryce Lynch. And we actually will have a guest next week who is one of my very good friends and the reason that I got so far into DCC. So until next week, that's all I've got. Do you have anything, Peyton?
Nope.
All right. Well, I hope you guys have a good week. We will talk to you later.
Yep. See you all next time.